The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for an audience of blind and print-impaired folks. And I'm hoping that's you all, and that you will be interested in hearing John Federson read a weekly installment of the Independent, the Indie Week magazine. The issue is dated to September 21st of 2023, and it is full of articles, and I better not have any funny business and just get on with the reading. Now, primary election times coming up in Durham, among other places. There are several long articles and short about the Durham primaries and the election in general. And I'll start, though, with first two shorter articles from Raleigh, North Carolina. And the first, the Christmas Parade, which will take place this year. It will go forward, but on foot this year. The city's initial decision to cancel the parade ground parade garnered criticism from residents and organizers during the city council meeting on Tuesday. Last week, they announced the Christmas parade organizers were denied a permit out of an abundance of caution and respect for the tragic death of 11-year-old Haley Brooks during last year's parade. An out-of-control truck that had gone uninspected for months struck the young dancer in front of hundreds of parade attendees. Following backlash over the cancellation, city officials partially reversed the decision, saying the parade would instead go forward as a pedestrian-only event without motorized vehicles or floats. That was a compromise between city officials and the Greater Raleigh Merchants Association and Shop Local Raleigh, the groups that helped organize the parade. Still, many residents, including Brooks's family, questioned why the city would cancel or modify the parade rather than implement stricter precautions, including those outlined in pending state legislation dubbed the Shine Like Haley Parade Safety Bill. That bill, which has passed the House but not the Senate, would require parade vehicles to be inspected within 1 week of the event, among other stipulations. Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin has said one reason the city initially decided to cancel was because the bill and its new regulations have not yet become law. The city was also concerned about ongoing lawsuits against parties, including the Greater Raleigh Merchants and Shop Local Raleigh, although the city itself was not named as a defendant. Three other parades with automobiles and floats have been permitted by the city since November of 2022, said Martin, with the city imposing no additional safety requirements beyond a new rule requiring parade vehicles provide proof of registration and insurance. Meanwhile, organizers of the Christmas parade have met this and other city regulations and also added additional safety rules, added Martin. Under these new rules, parade drivers must be at least 20 years old, ride with a 21 years old, ride with a 21-year-old passenger, and demonstrate their vehicles have passed the safe state inspection. And Martin ended her comments by handing out a document to city council members outlining the new rules, saying, "Permitting other parades with less stringent requirements sets a bad precedent and unfairly singles out the Raleigh Christmas Parade. We are simply asking for the opportunity to present to you what we have worked on and how we want to help make all events in the city of Raleigh safer." Second Raleigh event, ordinances from the city council. Compared to some entertainment districts, Glenwood South in Raleigh is a humble strip. It doesn't have bustling crowds of New Orleans Bourbon Street, rowdiness of Austin's 6th Street, or the live music presence of Nashville's Beale. But the strip has grown into a booming bar and club scene over the last decade. Conflicts around noise and safety have divided Glenwood South's identity in two. For some, a residential, family-friendly haven, and for others, a weekend nightlife destination. City Council member Jonathan Melton says there's this culture and vibe of Glenwood South that's beneficial to the city, but it's not safe, and if people who live nearby can't enjoy their homes, it's going to consistently be a problem. What we need to do is strike a good balance. And new ordinances that are before the council now are attempting to find that sweet spot between the two. This summer, the city attorney brought two proposals to the council. First is a noise ordinance, which would replace the current structure of Glenwood South's noise policing. The second is a nightclub permit proposal, and that would enhance safety rules and impart harsher penalties on businesses that qualify as nightclubs, which violate them. These ordinances were proposed after years of mitigating noise level and safety concerns between residents and entertainment business, says Larry Miller, president of the Glenwood South Neighborhood Collaborative. He notes that more than 4,300 people reside on Glenwood South. And he says they choose to live here because it's a great community. It's walkable, has lots of amenities around, but on weekend nights, it's an entertainment district, and you get tens of thousands of individuals that come here to party. The noise ordinance, first, would change Raleigh's system of noise regulation for the district. Currently, that system is based on decibel readings that police officers take. But the ordinance would switch it over to a reasonable person standard in which, during nighttime hours, any, quote, reasonable person standing more than 150 feet away from the source of the sound can report noise that they deem unacceptably loud. And according to the ordinance, a reasonable person is defined, of course it is, as a person of normal and ordinary sensitivities who is within the area of audibility or perceptibility of the noise or vibration that transmits sounds which disrupt the reasonable conduct of basic human activities like conversation, sleep, work, and other such activities. The ordinance does not make any changes to the fines that businesses receive for noise complaints, but rather to the means of enforcing these complaints, says Melton. Quote, my understanding is that with the decibel reader they were using before, it's difficult or impossible to actually precisely trace it back to a single source of noise. And so when you have an area that's generally loud, it's difficult to enforce it because you can't prove that it's coming from one certain place. The proposed reasonable person standard would cut out reliance on machinery entirely and instead would depend on residents to call in complaints to police officers, who would then have the onus of deciding whether the noise is unreasonable before issuing a citation to the business that's causing the amplified sound. But sound concerns aren't the only thing weighing on the neighborhoods and streets of Glenwood South. Safety on the Strip has been a hot topic this summer after two shootings took place in the span of 2 months, as well as a rise in drug dealing, weapons, larceny, and assaults. Melton says, I do think a lot of what we're seeing now with spillover into the neighborhoods and the destruction of personal property and gun violence, we have to address that or it's going to become a much bigger problem. I'm all for having that cultural, fun, booming Glenwood South area, but we have got to get a handle on these other issues or it's all going to go away. The other proposed ordinance, that nightclub permit, focuses almost entirely on safety, scrapping the existing entertainment permit process for an entirely new model and threatening fines as high as $5,000 for first-time non-compliance with these new rules. In 2014, City Council adopted a system for amplified entertainment permits, AEP, and hospitality district entertainment permits, HDEPs. Glenwood South was considered a hospitality district, so bars and clubs on the Strip could apply for an HDEP that would allow amplified entertainment for special events on the premises, not otherwise permitted in a hospitality district, according to that permit. The proposed permit does away with those categories entirely, instead proposing a new definition in which any establishment that uses 10% of its standing space for dancing, has live or recorded entertainment, and allows the consumption of alcoholic beverages qualifies as a nightclub. All nightclubs will require a nightclub permit. That permit requires a number of steps. In addition to heightening security presence and safety members for nightclubs with parking lots, every establishment is required to provide the manager's name and contact information so that it's available to the public, as well as to install a shunt trip breaker, also known as a kill switch, that, quote, can eliminate all sound from sound-producing devices, lights, jukeboxes, and any other electronic devices with the press of a button. It's unclear whether the shunt breaker, which several businesses already have installed, would be used solely for emergency purposes, but pressing the kill switch on a busy night could cost that business revenue, says Glenwood South DJ Jeffrey Sherman. It's kind of ludicrous to me, says, that someone should be able to affect thousands of dollars of commerce. This isn't the only potential cost for nightclubs. A first-time offense against any of the permit's requirements is a $5,000 civil penalty and permit suspension until compliance. Second-time offense in that same 12-month period is a one-year revocation with no appeals. Miller says that one major hole in the wording is it doesn't provide any information on how the nightclub process works or how businesses will be notified that they are defined as a nightclub. Miller asks, let's say you have a restaurant and once a month you have a band comes in and plays for the diners. You don't have a dance floor, but everybody in the restaurant's watching your performance. Does that now make you a nightclub? If they didn't realize they were a nightclub and didn't have that shunt breaker, they get a fine. And if they don't get it fixed within a reasonable frame, they lose their permit. To receive feedback on these ordinances and fill any potential holes in the writing, the council held two listening sessions in August where the public was invited to comment. Angela Floyd, a resident at Paramount Condominiums, which backs up to several bars on Glenwood South, spoke at these sessions about her experience as a resident, saying, "We made the move about 9 years ago and really enjoyed it. But about 7 years ago, things kind of started to change over on Glenwood South. Raleigh gets a lot of attention for being one of the best cities in the United States, and I'm proud of that. I think we're a great city, but I feel that Glenwood South has really lost its charm." Floyd says the strip used to be dotted with a few bars, a tapas restaurant, florist, burger joint, and a guitar shop. Now, Glenwood South is just bar after bar. "Since we sit right behind it, we are impacted by that late-night loud noise, the vibrating music and the motorcycle noise. At least from Friday to Sunday, the noise would be so loud, I mean, it really would rattle the windows in our bedroom." That noise got especially bad following the outbreak of COVID. When businesses started opening back up, the city encouraged bars, restaurants, and nightclubs to build up their outdoor dining and entertainment space. And while they helped people participate in post-pandemic life again while feeling safe, they worsened the amplified music projection. Since then, owners have realized they need to scale back on noise, and residents and bar owners are currently sitting at the closest thing to an equilibrium they've had in years. But while the noise ordinance switch from decibel levels to reasonable person seems like it's placing more of a limit on noise, Miller doesn't think much will change. And he says, "I think some people think it's going to be stricter, and you're going to hold the businesses to higher standard, but personally, I don't think that's the case, because under the old standards, it's 65 decibels. That's pretty quiet. That's basically conversation level." Both noise and nightclub permit raise questions of effectiveness, but Sherman says if there's one thing that unites entertainers and residents, it's concerns over safety. That new district made news back in May when First Lady Kristen Cooper criticized the late-night partying and the city's inability to manage it following an intrusion on the Cooper's nearby private residence in the early morning hours one weekend. Just last month, the general manager of a local restaurant died following an assault that took place in the 500 block of Glenwood South around closing time. Sherman says there's a 2 a.m. hard cutoff on clubs, and what happens is you have this mass exodus of half-intoxicated people mixing in with the religious extremists, college kids, when you have all these people in one time leaving and they all have the same goal in mind, they're just trying to get home, bad things happen. Fights break out. Things disrupt neighborhoods. Sherman says a makeover of Glenwood South could make a big difference in behavior. The streets need to be repaved. The sidewalks need to be cleaned up. It just doesn't look like a 2023 model. It looks like a 1987 piece of crap Buick that's about to break down, he says. And you know what? If we keep shoveling this weight onto it, it is going to break down. What I'm proposing is a makeover of the strip. We need to add art installations that promote positive messages. It's clear there's still work to be done. But no matter what the council decides regarding the two ordinances, its efforts show that the city believes Glenwood South is something worth saving, says Floyd. I'm optimistic. I want to try something different. We know what we have hasn't worked, but that's kind of like continuous quality improvement. You try something, it doesn't work. You take it back, and you try it again. And I appreciate a city that is willing to do that. Now, I am going to read a long article. I may do some trimming of it from about the Durham municipal elections. It's a part of a four-part series, part four, by Matt Hartman. The new Indie Week is featuring work by some authors who do longer form essays. And this one is a long one. And I'll probably want to do some trimming because I have other things to read. It's a Friday morning in early September, and Mike Woodard is sitting, legs crossed, at a table in front of Samuel and Sons Barbershop, dressed in the standard uniform of male politicians, trying to look casual. Khakis, a button-up, no tie, no socks. He seems at ease, like the front-runner he was assumed to be when he entered Durham's mayoral race 2 months before. The state senator and former Durham City Council member chose Anger Avenue Barbershop as a starting point for a tour of the surrounding East Durham neighborhood. The eponymous Samuel Jenkins is an old friend of Woodard's. Later, the barber delivers water and chastises Woodard for throwing away half a smoked cigar that Jenkins left on the table. When the tour begins at Woodard's silver Audi, he turns off the jazz station and points to businesses, old and new, lining Anger and Driver Street. There's Samuel and Sons, of course, which will soon be taken over by a nearby Latino barber shop after Jenkins retires. Ideals is a trendy sandwich spot whose patrons begin lining up before it opens every day. Joe's Diner, a stalwart restaurant owned by Mayor Elaine O'Neill's ex-husband, Joseph Bushman. It now focuses on catering and hawks hot dogs from a tent out front. Woodard loops past the newest businesses, Mike D's Barbecue and the Congress Bar and Cafe, before pausing at an empty lot around the block. He says, just a couple of years ago, we had an open-air homeless place. They took over this lot right here. This has just gotten cleaned up in the last couple of weeks, but you had four or five tents, guys sitting out here all day. Addicts were living here, is what we think was happening, but the dealers were coming and dealing fentanyl. A few blocks away, Woodard stops again, in front of that encampment's new location. Across the street, workers are building a row of nine new houses. As Woodard concludes the drive, circling back past Rofiwa, the black-owned bookstore and coffee shop that's still boarded up after a car crashed through its front window and a reported drug deal gone bad. It's not entirely clear what impression he hopes to give. Is Durham on the right path? Does it need to change direction? Woodard says, I think it's both and. I thought it would be helpful to see some investments and some of the things we have done, he adds, getting out of the car, and the challenges. What's the balance? I don't know. On the cusp of early voting for the primary, Durham seems split on the question, too. With the surprise stake by the city's sanitation workers, adding yet another twist to an already divisive election, that's a strike by the sanitation workers, consensus is not likely anytime soon. the core issues shaping what voters think of the balance, city council scandals, holistic policing strategies, ways to manage growth, were covered in the first three parts of this series. This final piece raises four key political questions. How voters answer them this fall will shape Durham's future. 1. What matters more, policy or personality? When her city council colleagues were debating whether to censure her for allegedly misusing city staff time to support her re-election campaign, Monique Holsey-Hyman was affronted. She said during a March council meeting, "It's troubling my heart. I put my name in the hat to help people, and I'm going to be 58, and I've won major awards. I've never in my life been sanctioned anything about ethics in my entire life." When I came on council, a lot of this was going on in terms of the tension, she tells the Indy. She was selected, she says, because her training as a social worker allows her to navigate emotionally fraught situations. "That's what people say to me," she says. "Dr. Hyman, you listen to us. You treat us with respect." She tells a story about the funeral of a murdered Hillside student to showcase what she'd like her campaign to focus on. "Some of the young men came in," she said. "They had ski masks. You could tell they were part of gangs. I said, if you really want this man's life to be something that you uplift, you've got to go back and do the right thing." And when I finished speaking, do you know what? These same young men who came in with their pants down and their ski mask, they came and hugged me. Because someone that comes in the communities, they are coming from. But Holsey-Hyman has not been able to focus on those stories because her re-election campaign has unfolded under the shadow of the scandal due to the censure, the Wikipedia ordeal, and an ongoing investigation into allegations she solicited a bribe from a developer. On Tuesday, after the Indy went to print, Durham District Attorney Satana DeBerry in a memo said a state investigator has found no evidence of wrongdoing on Holsey-Hyman's part relating to both the extortion allegation and the claim that she solicited a city staffer to work on her election campaign. Her ally, council member and mayoral candidate Didriana Freeman, is in a similar position. Also caught up in the Wikipedia scandal and still dogged by allegations that she threw a punch at fellow council member Mark Anthony Middleton, Freeman joins Holsey-Hyman in arguing that their policy positions and backgrounds are unfairly overshadowed. Just before she declared her intention to run for mayor, Freeman told the Indy that she wants the election to focus less on candidates, saying that the issue stopped being the driver and we have to get back to that. It was never likely, given the context. As if to prove the point, someone has begun attaching placards to her campaign signs that read, "She'll fight for Durham." Questions of character have shaped the election for every other candidate, too. Khalida Kareem, a city council candidate running for one of three at-large seats, says, "I was surprised with how many interviews I went on for endorsement that asked about temperament. Has behavior become a priority over ideology and policy preferences?" The Friends of Durham, the most conservative of Durham's major PACs and historically the home of the white business interests, endorsed progressive council member Javier Caballero, who is seeking re-election, despite targeting her in the last election with a mailer claiming she and her progressive allies were putting the police, quote, under assault. Dan Jewell, a longtime friend of Durham member who's helped with their endorsements, says, "Those of us who have known Javier for a while now feel like she's really matured into a complete council person. She gets it, and she seems to have shown the temperament in the last couple months to at least not get riled in public and participate in all the shenanigans." The group also chose not to endorse council member and mayoral candidate Leo Williams, a small business owner they backed in 2021, even though Jewell admits he fulfilled all our expectations, if not even more. Instead, the Friends of Durham endorsed Woodard. They reasoned it would allow them to bring in more people with the right personality, because Williams' council seat is not up for election this year, meaning he'll stay on the council if he loses the mayoral race. Jewell says, "We felt we needed as many steady hands and reasonable voices on the council as we can have. To us, it's a win-win." But Williams gained two other endorsements that seemed unthinkable before the campaign began. The self-described centrist is the progressive choice this year, winning recommendations from both of Durham's progressive PACs, the People's Alliance and Durham for All. Positioning himself as a candidate able to unify Durhamites of all stripes, given the role he played for much of the past 2 years as the go-between for city council's various blocks, it's not a stretch to say Williams won their backing because of his basic competence and ability to maintain cordial relationships. Durham for All Executive Director Whitney Maxey says he's proven to be someone who's steady and straightforward. We've never had to guess what his stance is. It's important to have someone who has that kind of consistency, but has also been reliable in his willingness to engage, even if we don't start out on the same page. Much of the opposition to Williams stems from feelings that the exact opposite is true. Supporters of Freeman, his opponent in the mayoral race, have frequently used public comment periods at city council meetings to criticize Williams for what they see as rudeness. Even Holsey Hyman echoes the complaint, though she doesn't name Williams explicitly. "There's one thing I've had a little problem with," she says. "The residents sometimes are not treated with respect when they come to our meetings." On the other hand, Planning Commissioner and City Council candidate Nate Baker, a progressive who frequently names capitalism as the source of injustice, failed to receive endorsements from either progressive PAC. He's seen as too friendly with problematic people with whom he aligns on development issues, sources say. Activists connected to the Inter-Neighborhood Council, INC, and others have spread groundless or disproven conspiracy theories targeting their political opponents, including Williams and Cavaliero. As early as July 2022, 5 months before the Planning Commission voted on whether to recommend SCAD, that controversial amendment to the Unified Development Ordinance, Baker met with INC to discuss how to organize against it. Baker has not propagated any of the conspiracy theories himself, but sources who attended the PA and Durham for All endorsement meetings report he lost both votes due to his perceived connections to those who had. Baker wouldn't address these sentiments in interviews. "I have never had bad interactions with fellow planning commissioners," Baker says. "In general, the Planning Commission has not been a toxic place. This is a body that has had a lot of very positive power." The next section of this article: are the PACs still the center of political power? Going into the 21 election, the PA was on a decade-long winning streak. Only a single of their endorsed municipal candidates had lost since 2009. In 21, the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, State, Slate, dominated. After a tumultuous 2 years, the question is whether 2021 was a sea change, a blip, or a sign of something else altogether. The person best positioned to answer it is a man who has been endorsed by both organizations in 8 previous elections, Mike Woodard. Coming back to Durham politics after 10 years in the state Senate, Woodard's pitch to voters is that he can bring a veteran presence the city needs to navigate this period, or perhaps just be an adult in the room. On our tour of East Durham, he's in his element as he rehashes the work done during his time on city council: small business grants, streetscape improvements, a failed pilot with early ShotSpotter-like technology, the creation of the Holton Resource Center. But experience has not resonated the way many expected. Though Woodard received the Friends of Durham endorsement, the group's influence has waned. Only the PA and DCABP have real sway in Durham elections now, and for the first time in his career, neither supported Woodard. Himself a part of the PA's old guard, Woodard received even fewer votes at the group's endorsement meeting than Freeman, the paragon of the PA's current opposition. But Woodard is unfazed. After O'Neill announced he would not seek re-election, Woodard said he started getting phone calls. He kept a tally on a card that he stashed in his jacket pocket. After the 40th call, Woodard says he stopped counting. He says, "I know the people who contacted me and asked me to run, and I'm out in the community talking to folks, so I don't worry about it a bit. I did not expect either of those two endorsements." Having raised more money so far than either Williams or Freeman, Woodard's campaign is a test case in whether there's an alternate route to the mayor's seat. Instead of the major PACs, his campaign is premised on the subject of influential community members, though Woodard declined to name anyone who asked him to run. He's not the only candidate trying to create a new base of political support outside BA and DCABP either. Freeman heads an unofficial slate of candidates, all who have close ties to INC, including Bonita Green, INC's president, who declined to participate in any endorsement process, Sherry Zahn Rosenthal, a former assistant city attorney, and Baker. Green says, "My feeling is that this is going to be a very different type of election than any other that Durham has had. I don't think this is an election that money can buy." There's a disclosure here. Green and I, the author, are both board members of DataWorks NC. The likelihood of Green winning a seat seems remote. Money may not buy an election, but it helps, and Green has raised less than $1,000. Rosenthal is faring better, raising just under $18,000, but that's still only sixth most among city council candidates. The fundraising leader is longtime PA activist Carol Rist, with over $80,000 to his campaign thanks to deep connections across Durham. It is enough to give the PA reason to believe it has righted the ship after 2021. If INC's backing alone isn't enough, though, it might help push other candidates over the edge, with INC providing a tailwind alongside to DCABP endorsement. Baker's campaign doesn't seem particularly troubled without the PA. He's second in money raised with nearly $40,000. By combining support from development-skeptical progressives, INC and DCABP, Baker's candidacy raises a related but distinct quandary alongside Woodard's. Are the centers of political power shifting? In recent years, DCABP, the historic home of black business and middle classes, has been aligned with Friends of Durham. Their endorsement lists have largely overlapped with moderate, business-friendly candidates pushing an enterprise and building-centric approach to community development. But as the current council has divided over housing and development, the slate DCABP endorsed 2 years ago split down the middle, with O'Neill and Freeman on one side, joined by Holsey Hyman after she was appointed, and with Williams and Middleton on the other. This year, DCABP members seem split as a result, producing a variable slate of endorsed candidates. The committee recommended Williams for mayor, but Holsey Hyman and Baker for city council, along with Sheila Huggins, an attorney and former Friends of Durham board chair. "Our slate is like a holistic approach," says DCABP PAC chair Cassandra Stokes. "Each candidate brings a different skill set that will be beneficial to the council." There isn't a single substantive issue in Durham politics that whole slate agrees on, from housing policy to police reform, but Stokes says that's by design. She says all of these candidates in their expertise speak to a different issue that Durham has seen over the years. That's what makes a successful city council. Our slate reflects Durham. We have a mix of different backgrounds and people in different fields. But others say that that's the result of an organization that has become as contentious as Durham at large. The most notable critic is one of their own slate, Leo Williams. And he said in an interview with Indy on the day he announced his candidacy for mayor, "There are more good people who care about our community than not. But I'd be a fool if I were to pretend they were not toxic people, tarnishing the history and purpose of the committee. That has implications. It wasn't as bad when I was endorsed by the committee in 2021. It's really bad now." And the next question, who is the progressive leader after Jillian Johnson leaves office? When Jennifer Carroll, a member of Durham's Community Safety and Wellness Task Force, was first getting involved in local politics, she knew little about the city council. And she says, "I knew who Jillian was because I live in Durham and I have eyes." Since she was first elected in 2015, Johnson has been a dominant force in Durham politics and not just among her progressive allies. She's long been the boogeyman for political opponents, whether for her policy choices or influence in progressive organizations. After a contentious budget vote in June, Freeman even alluded to her as one of the two puppet masters of council, along with Middleton. Now, Johnson will be leaving office. Her absence will shape both the city council and Durham's progressive movement. Observers are already pointing to the relatively short tenure of the current council members as one reason for its visible dysfunction and tension. Johnson has served the longest. Former Mayor Bill Bell, who served 26 years as a county commissioner and 16 as a mayor. "You didn't have a wealth of experience at that council. Even though I haven't been on council in 11 years, I still have more council service than anybody else running." With community trust at a low point, the question is whether anyone can fill the gap. Middleton, who succeeded Johnson as mayor pro tem, was assumed to be Durham's next mayor in waiting before this election cycle, but he didn't run. And he's found himself in an antagonistic relationship with citizens at recent council meetings, telling critics repeatedly to run against him if they don't like his positions, and often eliciting jeers from the crowd. Freeman, whose stature and influence grew during O'Neill's term, is another possibility, should she become mayor, but her failure to receive major PAC endorsements indicates her support runs narrow, even if it runs deep. In either case, neither Middleton nor Freeman have had easy relationships with Durham progressives centered around the PA and Durham for All, so they're looking for a way to transition into their next era. Still, progressives will have to replace their figurehead, and there is no apparent successor. Johnson has promised to stay involved in local politics, but will have to support fellow progressives without the built-in bully pulpit of the council dais. Caballera is a popular incumbent in her own right, and Rist's fundraising haul speaks for itself, so there's reason for Durham progressives to feel optimistic heading into the election, but a burden of uncertainty falls on Khalila Karim, a former labor organizer now with the League of Conservation Voters. Karim is not nearly as well known as Caballero and Rist. She has been labeled the new Jillian by supporters and opponents alike, and she seems to embrace the characterization, saying, "People have been talking about it. I don't take it in a negative way. I think about what Jillian has done in her terms on the council, and I'm like, if only I can be as lucky to get as much done." Karim's background and Johnson's support were enough to win the PA and Durham for All endorsement, But PA sources say Baker nearly beat Karim to the third spot on the slate. Baker has won supporters among moderates and progressive alike by taking a more critical view of development issues that have been central to this election thus far. With growth taking center stage as Johnson steps out of the limelight, there's reason to question whether her influence will carry as much weight as it once did. Johnson spearheaded a successful slate with Caballero and Charlie Reese when she was on the campaign trail herself in 2019. But her support was not enough to give Marianne Johnson much success when she challenged Freeman in 2021. Rist, who earned her endorsement this year and supports the PA and Durham for All slate, says Johnson's absence will leave a vacuum. From an organizing and intellectual perspective, she's been a true leader, he says. Karim is focused on trying to carve out the space to be her own candidate, saying new leadership in itself doesn't have to be bad. A lot of the time people get used to seeing the same people in office, and I think we need to change that up, actually. We need to give space for a lot of different folks to run. And next section. What can voters realistically expect from city council? 10 years ago, Durham was in the midst of an ugly political fight over development, with many of the same talking points and people as today. It started in 2005 with a change to Jordan Lake's watershed boundaries, which enabled Southern Durham Development to plan a 13-home project called 751 South that made a long and tortured journey through local government over the next 8 years. In 2013, City Council voted against annexing the project into city limits, the second time the request was denied. Southern Durham Development wanted annexation because it meant the city would provide water and sewer service. They weren't taking no for an answer, and ultimately the General Assembly forced Durham to annex the property. 751 South officially became part of the city of Durham this June, around the same time the state lawmakers forced municipalities to extend utilities to charter schools after Durham City Council refused to do so. For many of Durham's elected officials, those cases provide an essential lesson. It's not just that North Carolina law strictly curtails local government's powers. It's that lawmakers are quick to jump on the chance to punish blue cities that go too far. The General Assembly can repeal a city charter, effectively legislating the city out of existence, without the city's residents getting a say in the matter, if it pleases. With a Republican supermajority in the legislature and control of the courts, things are only worse now. Statements about fiduciary responsibility make for uninspiring campaign speeches, even when they're true. But even those taking a more fiery approach admit the constraints. Freeman says she would provoke a fight with the General Assembly in order to push the envelope on new strategies, especially around affordable housing, but only if voters are willing to bear the consequences. 1,000%, Freeman says, when asked if she'd be willing to risk a lawsuit, as long as the city is willing to be taxed. You're going to end up in court, and I would say that because the way the courts are in North Carolina and now the Supreme Court in the country, it's not likely we would win, and so it would be an exercise in futility, but I'd be willing to be a test case. Her colleague on the council, Caballero, takes a different view. If you want to go poke the bear, go poke the bear, she says. I'm not going along with you on that suicide mission, not now. But a city can control its budget, and that became a central issue this month as sanitation workers lost an unexpected strike. Ironically, the strike gave a lifeline to Freeman and Hulsey Hyman while putting progressives on the back foot. The seed was planted in the budget vote in June when O'Neill belatedly asked for a raise for firefighters less than 2 weeks before the city was required by law to have passed a balanced budget. It doesn't appear the request was ever raised during budget negotiations, but at the meeting, confusion ensued. Council members asked if the raise was only for firefighters, other first responders, or all city staff. A majority, Johnson, Caballero, Williams, and Middleton, said they didn't want to raise taxes beyond the increase that the county had already passed, especially without a clear plan. Eventually, the council approved the budget without the original additional raises, with the understanding there would be a pay study and requisite increases next year. And the majority said it was the responsible option. The sanitation workers didn't want to wait that long. UE 150, which doesn't make any specific budget requests earlier this year, showed up to the September 7th work session, demanding immediate $5,000 bonuses, that temporary workers be hired as permanent staff, and that employees get paid for work outside their official duties. O'Neill said at that meeting, "There were three of us that saw this day coming back in June. We had the opportunity and we tried, so I won't take that it's all of us. I won't bear that burden. This has it to be exactly where it is, on four." In the face of such direct attacks, the majority responded with appeals to pragmatism. And Williams said to the workers, "If I'm being honest, I think we're being borderline irresponsible right now. I don't want to position us to where we have a momentary sensation and fall apart later." The smarter thing to do, Williams argued, ensure that any raise was sustainable, which required time. But ultimately, implementing the demand isn't up to the council. Day-to-day operations of city government are left to staff. This weekend, City Manager Wanda Page presented her plan, which calls for bonuses of up to $3,000 for all city workers. The lowest paid received the most, but the union isn't satisfied. The organization said in its statement, "Members of the Durham City Workers Union are sticking with the demand for $5,000 bonus for all city employees making less than $75,000. They noted their plan would cost roughly the same as Page's. If a compromise is reached that leaves all parties reasonably happy, Williams, Caballero, and their allies may end up looking like effective politicians who were able to usher protest into policy. But if the union remains unsatisfied, the council members' critics will have the ammunition they need to write the next chapter in a story about Durham politicians being out of touch with the city's working-class black residents." Middleton said, presiding over a council meeting Monday in place of the absent O'Neill, "We will proceed in regular order tonight." That was a message to the sanitation workers lining the first row of council chambers following a pre-meeting rally. There would be no vote on those bonuses. Middleton told them, "We want to encourage everyone who can to attend on Thursday, when Her Honor the Mayor will be back and the full council will be in session to engage and do what we said we were going to do when we passed the budget." Well, Thursday is the same day early voting begins for the primary. "Yes, you do deserve it," Middleton added. The meeting was paused as the workers filed out of the room, and the council returned to the rest of its business and a mostly empty gallery. On the agenda, four public hearings on new development cases. And that concludes this four-part series about Durham's municipal elections. Now, in the interest of my one-hour time slot, there are the 2023 endorsements from Indy Week, their editorial and writing staff, for this municipal primary. And I must just take these down to let you know. You could go to indyweek.com and read their rationale for the several paragraphs for each endorsement. But I will just read the names because I have many other things to try to get to today. So, Durham is at a crossroads. Here are the 2023 picks for Durham mayor and the three at-large seats on the city council. And the mayor's, the Indy Week is endorsing Leonardo Williams. And the other candidates, Mike Woodard and Deidreana Freeman, they have issues that take them a little bit below Leonardo Williams' endorsement. For the city council at large, there are three seats, and the three names, Javier Caballero, Nate Baker, and Carol Rist. Other candidates, Sheila Huggins to be considered, and Kalila Karim. And this was three dense pages of rationale for these endorsements, and I do not have time to read that for you. But there they are. Now, does Mara Gatewood, a staff of the LGBTQ Center of Durham staff, has written a long article, Portraits of Pride, Proudly at Odds, Boldly Queer. This article, Proudly at Odds, Boldly Queer, by this Mara Gatewood, begins with a long introduction and then gives self-portraits, including verbal and written self-portraits, by many, many people in the LGBTQ arena. Whenever I become clouded in what queerness looks like in action, I reflect on how the writer Bell Hooks describes queerness, not about who you're having sex with, but as being about the self that is at odds with everything around it. I reference that definition because it thoroughly captures my experience as a black queer person in America. It gives language for illustrating how queerness is the diamond birthed from pressure of two forces, the world's fight to change us and our fight to change the world. Now, fighting to change the world is where I hope to stay, and my story of evolution from queer confusion to confidence is perfectly reflected in my ascension from an unsettled member of an underground tribe of queer teenagers to a self-assured member of a board for an organization that hosts the unapologetic pride celebration of the Bull City, the LGBTQ Center of Durham. In high school, I cycled through reshuffling cliques before discovering a home base, emo and skater kids. We were like an affinity group of believers in the gospel of social rebellion. The skate park became the sanctuary for the misfits. The band with the same name created our hymns. Their band t-shirts were our choir robes. We had communion over gas station snacks and canned soda. One more camel crush for the road was our benediction. We were at odds with the world, so we created one of our own. And I will just run down the names of the staff of the LGBTQ Center of Durham. And with each photograph of them are in their personal views and stories about queerness and about why they are where they are at this point in their lives. And the first one is an interim executive director, Natalie Watson. And then the second is Carlos Hernandez, who is the Durham Pride co-chair, identifying as he and him. Those are the pronouns for all of these, each of these. Jesse Huddleston, he, she, them, we, is a Durham Pride co-chair. Single name, Hunter, pronoun they. Healthcare manager. The survivor service coordinator is E. Right, and they, them, pronoun for that. Alex Adrian is he, him, operations manager. Director of Gender Advocacy and Support, Vanity de Terville. She, her, and hers. I'll leaf through this to get to the next section of portraits. There are quite a few on this staff. Shay Lloyd, identifies as they, them, case manager for the Southern Queer Survivor Network. Freddie Perkins, he, him, as the Youth Center co-director. Jiminy Gatecum, she, her, director of housing, therapy services, and a multidisciplinary artist. And I might mention that many of the illustrations are photographs, but many are also paintings and drawings by various of these individuals. And Jiminy Gatcombe, that I've already introduced to you. In masculine form, Niccolo Roditi. And in feminine form, Kali Fukas is the co-director of the LGBTQ Youth Center. Ray Dooley is they, them, Southern Queer Survivor Network director. And let's see, I believe that ends that article. It's a long one, partially due to all the illustrations and drawings and photographs. But for anyone interested and moved by this movement in society, and especially around Durham, that's a good place to get a start, the LGBTQ Center of Durham. And I'm already at the two-minute mark. And below, I will have no time to read the six or seven other arts-related, cultural-related articles, even a review of a sushi place and a gas station, behind a gas station in Apex. And that's been on hold for several issues. I haven't been able to get to that. They're in my folder. And I will just promise to do my best to infiltrate some of these articles now that those particular long articles about the Durham election are behind us. And just a reminder that these Durham municipal primary will be held on Tuesday, October the 10th. October the 10th coming up. Voter registration deadline, October 13th. And absentee by mail voting for the municipal primary is October 10th. And one-stop early voting ends on October the 7th. Remember, please, to be registered, and also voting will require photo IDs for participants who wish to vote. So get in touch with your local elections board, and this applies to anybody within listening range of my powerful North Carolina Reading Service voice, urging you to pay attention to even these smaller elections if you want to be able to make some change, including change close to home. So John Fetterson will go away after preaching to you and be back with Indie Week next week from the North Carolina Reading Service.